first case of the day, Wachovia versus Banco. Mr. Smolens.
May it please the court. Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Mark Smolens, and I appear here this morning on behalf of two of the individual defendants' appellants, Andrew Jehelka and Richard Nichols. Your Honor, the defendants respectfully submit that the erroneous assertion of a waiver with respect to the choice of law to be used to make the corporate veil-piercing determinations at issue in this case, and more importantly, the error in refusing to apply South Dakota corporate governance law with respect to the degree of adherence by Loop and its principals to corporate formalities, calls into question the very sufficiency of the veil-piercing judgments entered against them below.
What difference does South Dakota law really make here as opposed to Illinois law?
Well, it makes a difference for a number of reasons, Your Honor. With respect to the actual substantive law, it's pretty similar. But with respect to the internal affairs doctrine and the court's determinations about the adherence to corporate formalities, which had to have been, even if you accept the waiver argument, there's no possibility that you could have waived the court's consideration of South Dakota law with respect to the internal affairs doctrine. And when the court finds that Loop didn't adequately adhere to corporate formalities, that determination should have been made under South Dakota law. And under the South Dakota Code, for example, Your Honors, when the principals made distributions to each other outside, not in proportion to the shares in the stock that they held, which the district court found was important in terms of failure to adhere to corporate formalities, the South Dakota Code specifically permits that. The South Dakota Code also, Your Honors, says that even if the principals of Loop had acted in a manner to treat this corporate entity as a partnership or failed to adhere to corporate formalities, they can't be held individually liable. So what we're saying, Your Honors, is the reason that the principals of Loop, based on the advice of their lawyers back in 1997, went to South Dakota and incorporated there because it was a quote-unquote friendlier jurisdiction for corporations like this, small, closely held corporations, it wasn't just because the cost of incorporation in South Dakota was lower, but it was the way that South Dakota courts allow small, closely held companies like Loop to operate.
Mr. Smolens, if this was so important and such a strategic choice, why wasn't it raised earlier than it was in the district court?
I don't know why it didn't show up in the summary judgment pleadings, Your Honor, but we were talking about a bench trial here. And in a bench trial...
Now, the case had been litigated for 4 years under Illinois law, correct?
Yes, Your Honor, it had. And in the summary judgment pleadings, I think we saw that...
And why isn't that a waiver?
It's not a waiver, Judge, because there was an Illinois entity in the summary judgment pleadings, which is really the substance of the prior litigation.
But the whole issue in summary judgment, one of the main issues in summary judgment, was the doctrine of piercing the corporate veil, correct?
It was, but they were not only dealing
litigated
with
Loop, entire, but NOLA. Briefed and litigated entirely under Illinois law.
Because NOLA was an Illinois limited liability company, and I don't have an answer. There is no good answer why it was ignored, Your Honor.
I agree.
They were wrong. They were wrong, but it's a bench trial. And when you have a bench trial, Your Honor, at the end of the case, at least every bench trial that I've ever participated in, at the close of the case, the trial judge says to the parties, now submit your proposed findings of fact and conclusions of law, which they did here. And logically, Your Honors, that's the time when the issue should have been raised. Rather than coming up with these legal gymnastics that we're going to create a waiver because we don't want to apply South Dakota law.
So the judge sits through all of the evidence without a clue as to what the law is to be and makes evidentiary rulings and so forth. That doesn't sound like much of a way to try a case.
It's not a question of not having a clue as to what the law is. The law is the law. Aren't we supposed to try and get it right? Isn't the judge supposed to make her assessment of Loop's adherence to
corporate
formalities?
We've said many times, Mr. Smolens, that courts will respect parties' choice of law. And when parties choose to litigate under one law, we'll respect that.
There was no conscious decision by Loop to litigate this case under Illinois law, Your Honor. In fact, in the opening statements, not just by the defense, but by the plaintiff, counsel for the plaintiff stepped up and said, Your Honor, Loop is a South Dakota corporation. There's never been any question about that. And this case should be litigated under South Dakota law.
That's not what he said, though, the second half of that. You're not suggesting that he said the case should be litigated under South Dakota law.
He said that the law of South Dakota applies.
Was the same.
What's that?
I thought he said it was the same.
And in part, he was correct. But he was not correct with respect to the internal affairs doctrine, Your Honors. We concede, Your Honors, that South Dakota law with respect to the actual the elements of the corporate veil piercing are similar between South Dakota and Illinois. But we respectfully maintain that the provisions of Section 47.1A-732.5 of the South Dakota Corporate Code should have been applied to the trial court's determinations with respect to Loop's adherence to corporate formalities. And what were those? Well, the court in South Dakota tells us that we have to consider the degree to which corporate formalities have been maintained. Under the South Dakota Code, we look at how the court dealt with this issue in Kansas Gas and Electric, the seminal case decided by the court. And there, the court noted that the South Dakota Corporation in Kansas Gas hadn't had a corporate meeting for 7 years. Here, the evidence was that the defendants met on a daily basis. There were no minutes. Here, there were no minutes. But what else did they find in the South Dakota case? Your Honors, they acted as a corporation. They entered into contracts in their own name. They filed tax returns. All of those things were done by Loop in this case. Corporate records. In the South Dakota case, in our case, corporate resolutions were maintained when the particular incident required. In fact, when Loop entered into the contract with Wachovia,
or on an as-needed basis, right?
Correct, Your Honors. My clients and Mr. Greenblatt were not the kind of businessmen who sit around and take notes and prepare corporate resolutions. The description that we've seen of them as three men and a telephone is not an in-app description. And there's all kinds of evidence in the record about the manner in which Loop maintains their offices with other related entities. The trial court deemed that to be inappropriate adherence to corporate formalities, and we respectfully maintain that if the court had been considering that under the internal affairs doctrine under South Dakota law, those findings would have been erroneous. When Loop needed a corporate resolution to enter into the margin account agreement with Wachovia, they did. The trial court tells us that Loop was not adequately capitalized, that Loop was a sham corporation. Yet, a few pages later in the opinion, the district court points out or claims that Loop had $32 million worth of assets that were encumbered by the Banco lien, and later asserts that Loop and its principals transferred millions of dollars worth of assets in an attempt to delay or hinder creditors. Judge, for these reasons, we believe that if South Dakota law was properly applied pursuant to the internal affairs doctrine, the unity of interest prong from Kansas Gas or under Illinois law applied using the correct law, South Dakota, simply could not be met by a preponderance of the evidence. With respect to the second element of the inquiry, the fraud or other equitable considerations, Your Honor, under South Dakota law, there must be a causal relationship between the failure to observe the corporate formalities and the claimed fraud or inequity. And the Illinois courts are similar. They're the same. They have similar assertions under Illinois law. But what the Kansas Gas Court says in one of their quotes, it is only when the shareholders disregard the separateness of the corporate entity and when that act of disregard causes the injustice or inequity or constitutes the fraud that the corporate veil may be pierced. Simply because a contract is breached or because a debt cannot be repaid does not constitute the injustice or inequity required. For indeed, Your Honors, if that is the proper formulation for veil piercing, then any time a corporation's assets are exceeded by its liabilities, that corporation is no longer going to be in a position to act. They're not going to be able to pay employees or shareholders' distributions, but they're going to have to simply shut down until that creditor is paid, and that's not the way corporations and business occurs in this country. Because of the deficiencies asserted by the district court about Loop's compliance with corporate formalities had no causal relationship whatsoever to Loop's inability to meet its debt to Wachovia, that aspect of the decision below should be reversed. And for all these reasons that I've set forth...
Is it your position that insolvent corporations are entitled to distribute millions of dollars to their shareholders?
No, Your Honor. I don't believe that the evidence supports an assertion that that occurred here. But an insolvent corporation is entitled to take business steps, at least if you read the section that I quoted from the South Dakota Code, which is theoretically should have been applied here because of the Internal Affairs Doctrine, which we don't believe could be waived. They're entitled to make business steps to try and save the corporation, which is what occurred here, Your Honors. They spent a lot of money. Mr. Greenblatt, Mr. Jahelka, and Mr. Nichols spent a lot of time and effort to try and save the EasyLink stock.
Is that where the $518,000?
Correct, Your Honor. There was an influx of capital into EasyLink.
That was coincidental with the margin call, wasn't it?
I don't believe it was coincidental. I think it was subsequent to the margin call, Your Honor.
Well, okay.
Your Honor, I see my yellow light is on. I would like an opportunity to reserve some of the rebuttal time for my portion of the rebuttal.
Before you sit down, Mr. Smolens,
sure,
could you tell me who's paying Loop's counsel in this case?
I don't know the answer to that, Your Honor.
Does anyone know that answer?
Loop's lawyer might.
Who's not here?
Well, we were told we could only have two people argue, mm-hmm. so we made the decision to have counsel for two of the individuals argue.
Perhaps Mr. Curley can tell me. So.
Thank you, Judge.
Early.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. My name is Philip Curley, and I represent Banco Panamericano, Inc. The revised second amended complaint in this case filed by Wachovia contained a single claim against Banco under the Illinois Uniform Fraudulent Transfer Act. That's count 9 of the complaint. In connection with a blanket lien granted by Banco to Loop on April 1, 2002. The relief sought by Wachovia was specific, the voiding and rescinding of the, quote, April 1, 2002, end quote, lien. Now, the district court below ruled that the 2002 lien was a fraudulent transfer, a finding that we disagree with for the reasons set out in our briefs. But that seems to me to be more a matter of academic interest now, however, given Wachovia's position on appeal that the 2000 lien and the 2002 lien are one and the same, and that the 2000 lien is the only lien at issue. That was an argument, by the way, that Wachovia did not raise below, and we believe has therefore waived. The district court did not find the 2000 lien to be a fraudulent transfer under the Transfer Act, nor could it have done so, given its rulings during the trial that unpleaded transfers and transfers before May 2001 were off-limits for Transfer Act purposes. Notwithstanding that the district court did not allow Wachovia to contest the 2000 lien as a fraudulent transfer, Wachovia now asks this court to do exactly that. Respectfully, you should decline Wachovia's invitation. The threshold bar to this court now addressing the 2000 lien, or to addressing that lien now, I should say, under the Transfer Act, is that any such claim is time-barred. Section 10A of the Act, whether you call it a statute of limitations or statute of repose, extinguishes a fraudulent transfer claim under Section 5A1 unless it is brought within 4 years after the obligation was incurred. The only exception is statutory, that's also found in Section 10A, which provides that a claim may be brought later than 4 years, as was the case here, but only if it is brought within 1 year after the obligation was or reasonably could have been discovered by the claimant. The 2000 lien was granted on January 3, 2000. There is no dispute about that. So any Transfer Act claim brought after January 3, 2004 is time-barred unless Wachovia filed within 1 year of when it discovered or reasonably could have discovered the existence of the 2000 lien. Wachovia, in fact, in its brief before the court, relies on the 1 year statutory discovery period in Section 10A to argue that a 2000 lien claim would be timely, even though it did not plead the discovery rule in any of its four complaints below, even though it did not put into the record any evidence to support the discovery rule argument it now makes for the first time on appeal, and even though it did not raise the discovery rule in any respect in its post-trial submissions. In fact, its lawyers called not a single representative of Wachovia to testify about when and how it learned of the 2000 lien. Wachovia's sole citation in its brief to support the belated invocation of the discovery rule is not even evidence, but an ambiguous allegation in paragraph 8 of the revised Second Amendment complaint that its fraudulent transfer claims were, quote, based upon documents produced in this litigation on March 31, 2005, end quote. Now, first of all, of course, that allegation does not allege when Wachovia first learned of the 2000 lien. And second, Banco pleaded insufficient knowledge with respect to that allegation below, thereby denying it. So this total failure of proof means Wachovia simply did not carry its burden as to the only argument it could muster before this court to avoid the untimeliness of its claim as to the 2000 lien. But even if it were assumed that Wachovia could somehow excuse its failure of proof, any Transfer Act claim with respect to the 2000 lien would still be time-barred. That is because Wachovia, as a matter of law, reasonably could have and should have known of Loop's obligation to Banco and the blanket lien no later than June 17, 2002, by virtue of Banco's UCC filing on that date that put the world on notice of the lien.
What did Banco get in that 2002 lien that it hadn't already gotten in 2000?
It didn't get anything, Your Honor. That's why we don't believe there was a transfer in 2002.
The interest, whatever interests were transferred or security was given by that lien, was identical to the lien in 2000, right?
Yes, it was, Your Honor. And that's why, for instance, why Wachovia now, I believe, realizes that it has to look at the 2000 lien and not the 2002 lien, because there simply was no transfer from Loop to Wachovia in 2002. And so, therefore, any Transfer Act analysis of the 2002 lien ends right there with no transfer. Now, as I mentioned, Wachovia could and should have reasonably known of Loop's obligation to Banco on the blanket lien no later than June 17, 2002, due to that UCC filing. Because Banco is pursuing its 2000 lien claim later than 4 years after the obligation was incurred, but not within 1 year of when it could reasonably have discovered the existence of the lien, which would have been June 17, 2003, Wachovia simply cannot invoke the one-year discovery rule of Section 10A of the Transfer Act. Thus, if Wachovia had brought a cause of action on the 2000 lien when it first asserted fraudulent transfer claims in this case, in the First Amendment complaint filed on May 18, 2005, at which time, by the way, Wachovia admits it knew of the 2000 lien, that claim still would have been untimely. And even if Wachovia had brought a cause of action on the 2000 lien when the original veil-piercing allegations were made in this case on May 21, 2004, the claim would still have been untimely. Now, there are other reasons in addition to the claims being time-barred why this court should not take up the 2000 lien as a matter of first impression on appeal. I wanted to touch base on a couple of important preliminary matters, however. First, Banco has never disputed that for purposes of the Transfer Act, it was controlled by Mr. Greenblatt. In fact, it would have made no difference under the law of fraudulent transfers if the transactions between Loop and Banco had instead been between Loop and Mr. Greenblatt directly. Either way, what was involved is a commonplace and unremarkable business transaction, owner financing of a closely held business. And secondly, just to be clear, the Banco loans were not a sham. There is no dispute that the loans were funded, and then in return for the liens it granted, the Banco loop was advanced millions of dollars. Now, the court should not take up the 2000 lien now because, as already mentioned, the district court barred Wachovia from doing that exact thing at trial. So Wachovia should not be permitted to avoid the district court rulings by making that argument here before this court. Significantly, Wachovia has not appealed as error the district court's rulings barring it from contesting the 2000 lien under the Transfer Act. It would also be contrary to basic notions of due process and fairness to allow Wachovia to argue for the first time on appeal that the 2000 lien is a fraudulent transfer, because none of Wachovia's four complaints in this case ever mentioned the 2000 lien, much less put it at issue. Banco did not address below whether the 2000 lien was voidable under the Transfer Act. And finally, because no one, not Wachovia, not Banco, not the district court, in fact considered the 2000 lien under the Transfer Act below, there is unsurprisingly little or no evidence in the trial record upon which this court can now base a Transfer Act analysis of the 2000 lien. And there certainly is insufficient evidence for this court to find actual intent and fraud in fact under Section 5A of the Transfer Act with respect to the 2000 lien, Wachovia having abandoned all constructive fraud claims. Consistent with its pleadings, Wachovia below focused all of its energy on Loop's intent and Loop's state of affairs when Loop granted the 2002 lien to Banco. That is crucial because it is the facts and circumstances at the time the obligation was incurred that is relevant to any fraudulent transfer analysis. The circumstances at the two points in time here, January 3, 2000, the first lien, and April 1, 2002, the 2002 lien, more than 2 years apart, could not be more different. For example, while it was uncontested, that Loop generally was not paying its debts as they became due after May 2001, Loop was financially healthy and very solvent in January 2000 with $32 million in assets, as the district court found. And the 2000 lien was granted by Loop well before its relationship with Wachovia even began, and 15 months before the health risk management fraud was perpetrated on Loop that caused its financial difficulties in May 2001.
Mr. Curley, can you answer the question that I asked Mr. Smullins earlier?
I can't, Your Honor. I don't know who has paid Loop's fees on this appeal. Was that the question?
Yes.
I do know that for Banco, our fees have been paid by Banco or SCADA Corporation. We represent a SCADA Corporation below on this appeal.
Okay.
When you refer to the $32 million, I guess, what, equity, or how do you label that?
That was the value of the assets that the district court found Loop had in 2000.
Well, the reason, because of the reference that the other side made to the document number where there are, I don't know, what, 18 or something, other margin accounts. There are a bunch of other margin accounts, and they list them all, many thousands of shares of this HRMI stock. And I assume that's what you're referring to as the $32 million value that Loop held, right?
Actually, I don't think that's so, Your Honor. Those holdings in the HRMI stock were held in some of them may have been in 2000, but I think most of them were in 2001.
So you're saying that $32 million was not HRMI stock?
I don't believe it was entirely HRMI stock.
Well, not entirely, but substantially,
some of
it, or most of it, or what?
Certainly, Loop had substantial holdings. I don't know the dollar amount, Your Honor.
Well,
Loop did have substantial.
What was the $32 million made up of?
Interests in limited partnerships, real estate limited partnerships that owned buildings in downtown Chicago and elsewhere. The EasyLink stock, which is stock in a golf tee time reservation company.
And that's where the $518 million went.
$518,000, yes, Your Honor.
Thousands. I mix those numbers up.
and it had Loop had other holdings in addition to those. Loop was a holding company, had a number of investments. And in 2000, as the district court found, those investments had a value of $32 million.
But when it came time to the call on the margin account, by Wachovia, there wasn't anything, or there were more important things to pay, or what?
Well, I can't.
You can't answer that. For
I can't necessarily speak for Loop, but yeah. I can say this as a matter of business. Wachovia did not protect itself by getting adequate security for its margin loans. Its only security was the Hermes stock. When that stock tanked because of the fraud at Health Risk Management, the value of that collateral went to zero, and Wachovia then became an unsecured creditor. And the reason that is an unsecured creditor is as a result of its own failure of due diligence and to protect itself. And I don't think there's any obligation on the part of Loop to pay unsecured creditors. I don't think there's any obligation of Banco to advance additional monies to Loop to pay unsecured creditors. Wachovia could have, back in 2001, filed a lawsuit, obtained a judgment, sought a judicial sale of Loop's assets, which it did not do. I see my light is on. I'd like to save the balance of my time for rebuttal.
Before you sit down, Mr. Curley, could you explain, in light of the close relationship between Mr. Greenblatt and Banco, as described by the district court, why does it matter so much how we treat Banco as distinct from Mr. Greenblatt?
Well, as I said in my remarks this morning, for purposes of the Transfer Act, I don't think it does make any difference. Had Mr. Greenblatt personally and directly made the loans to...
We've got a judgment that holds him personally accountable here, right?
Under the veil-piercing claim, yes, mm-hmm. Your Honor.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So, in light of that judgment, how much difference does the Banco judgment make?
Well, there is no judgment against Banco, Your Honor. There's just a...
On the UFTA.
Mm-hmm. Well, it makes a difference because Banco has a valid lien on Loop's assets, the principal remaining asset being the shares in the EasyLinks company, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Griesmeier.
May it please the court, counsel. I am Chris Griesmeier, and I am the lawyer for the plaintiff, Appellee Wachovia. Again, this case comes on appeal from a bench trial, and so the first thing that I'd like to talk about is the standard of review. And the standard review for a bench trial is clearly erroneous, clear error standard for all of Judge Kendall's findings of fact, as well as her application of those facts to the law. And it's important to note that this particular bench trial is the result of evidence that came exclusively from the defendants. Virtually every single document that was used at trial was a document that the defendants produced and the defendants generated. The rare exception would be the occasional demonstrative exhibit that Wachovia prepared. Every single witness that testified at trial was a defense witness. Mr. Greenblatt, Mr. Nichols, Mr. Jehelka, those were the three owners of Loop Corp. Mr. Neuhauser, which is Mr. Greenblatt's clerk. Mr. May, which was Loop's in-house accountant. Ms. Sharp, which was Loop's in-house lawyer. And then Mr. Jordan, who was Loop's outside counsel. Those were the witnesses who testified at trial. And Judge Kendall simply did not find any of their testimony and any of their explanations to be credible. And no appellate court can challenge the trial court's credibility determinations. And I think the fact that Judge Kendall didn't find anything that the defendants proffered or any explanations that any of the defendants proffered, the same explanations that they're now offering on appeal, the fact that she didn't find any of that credible is, I think, driving a large part of her opinion. In addition to the clear error standard for findings of fact and applications of fact to law, the grant of equitable relief, namely piercing Loop's corporate veil, that is governed under an abuse of discretion standard. The only question here that is governed by a de novo standard is a question of law, which would be whether we apply South Dakota law or Illinois law. And so at best, I think what the defendants here have done is they have simply presented the same facts that Judge Kendall heard at trial and said, these are the facts. I don't like the way Judge Kendall ruled. Please rule the other way. I suppose that's the essence of pretty much any appeal, but given these facts, given Judge Kendall's credibility determinations, and given this standard of review, I think they have a very uphill battle, and I don't think it's a battle that they're going to win. Now, in terms of the choice of law, Mr. Smolens argues on appeal that Loop Corp chose to incorporate in South Dakota because the law of South Dakota is favorable. And he cites this South Dakota statute. He says, listen, under the South Dakota statute, even if Loop Corp operated as a partnership and didn't observe any corporate formalities, then you couldn't pierce the corporate veil and you can't hold any of the shareholders liable. But the South Dakota statute that he actually cites, this applies to shareholder agreements. And this South Dakota statute says if the shareholders of a company enter into a shareholder agreement and that shareholder agreement deviates from the normal corporate formalities, the normal standards that corporation is supposed to keep, then if the shareholders follow that shareholder agreement, then they're not going to be personally liable. There is no shareholder agreement in this case. We asked for all of Loop's corporate records. Loop produced all of their corporate records. There was no shareholder agreement. Moreover, the statute that Mr. Smolin cites was enacted in 2005. Loop Corp was incorporated in South Dakota in 1997. So I don't think they could rely upon this South Dakota statute as the reason for their incorporating under South Dakota law. His second argument about the internal affairs doctrine.
South Dakota law was pretty corporate friendly prior to the enactment of that statute, wasn't it?
It was. I'm sure it was.
And how was the law different prior to the enactment? How does it favor your position prior to the enactment?
I don't think. You're essentially addressing pretty much our main point. I think you've already addressed it with Mr. Smolens. There is no material difference between South Dakota law and Illinois law with respect to the issue of veil piercing. I am not familiar with all of South Dakota's Corporations Act and all of the various provisions in that statute, just like I'm not familiar with all of the provisions in the Illinois Business Corporations Act. But I am familiar with the law of veil piercing under South Dakota and Illinois, and that's the issue of this case. And the law is virtually identical. The test is the same. Both South Dakota and Illinois apply the exact same two-prong test. And regardless of whether or not you're going to put any stock in Mr. Smolin's internal affairs doctrine, even though this isn't an internal affairs case, this isn't a proxy fight, this isn't a shareholder derivative suit, this isn't some sort of internal complaint between shareholders and the corporation. This is a veil piercing case. Even if you were to give credence to his argument now, he cannot escape the fact that he's waived the right to ask for an application of South Dakota law. In his summary judgment brief, Loop Corp, not just NOLA, but Loop Corp specifically sought summary judgment on the issue of veil piercing, relying exclusively on Illinois law. It never cited South Dakota law. It argued that Illinois law should apply. 3 months before trial, Loop Corp submits their proposed findings of fact and conclusions of law, which is the pretrial order. And in Loop Corp's proposed findings of fact and conclusions of law, Loop Corp again cites and relies exclusively on Illinois law. The first time they ever raise the issue of South Dakota law is during trial. So I think they've waived it, and I don't think they're going to get around that. But again, I think the point is rather academic because Illinois and South Dakota law, the tests are virtually identical. The first prong is there must be a unity of interest and ownership under Illinois or South Dakota law. And then the second prong is whether or not adherence to the corporate formality would sanction a fraud or promote injustice. Now, to the extent there is a difference, Illinois law provides a number of additional factors that the court can consider under the first prong, under the unity of interest and ownership. Illinois courts allow 11 factors for the courts to consider. South Dakota considers 4 factors. South Dakota's 4 factors, all of those are subsumed within Illinois's 11. So I think perhaps the reason they want to get away from Illinois law is because they have no defense to at least six of the factors that fall under the Illinois veil piercing claim. They don't have any defense to the issue of their failure to pay dividends. They don't have any defense to the issue of the fact that there were non-functioning officers and directors and Mr. Greenblatt.
Let me ask you about that, sure. Jehelka and Nichols. Judge Kendall clearly found that they were non-functioning directors. How do you get from that to a culpability for this this margin account?
Well, the culpability...
Greenblatt was running the show. I think that's your theory, and it's pretty clear from the record.
He wasn't, and I think that was definitely the evidence at trial. The culpability, it doesn't come into play during the first prong. The first prong of the veil-piercing test is there a unity of interest between the shareholders and the corporation? Is there a unity of interest? The culpability comes into the second prong. Second prong is, will observance of the corporate formality, will that sanction a fraud or promote injustice? And our contention at trial and our contention on appeal is the evidence shows that allowing the corporate formality to be observed here would promote injustice. We're not saying there's actual fraud, although there is some evidence of actual fraud. On appeal and at trial, we allege that if you let them adhere to the corporate formality, given the facts of this case, that is going to promote injustice.
By Jehelka and Nichols?
By allowing...
What did they do to promote an unjust result here?
They operated the company in such a way as they enriched themselves to the tune of almost $3 million in money that they took out of Loop Corp. They took, for themselves individually, they took $300,000 in off-the-books compensation from the company after Loop's margin debt came due. So they made all these payments, they took Loop's assets, they liquidated Loop's assets, or they funneled $1.4 million to Mr. Greenblatt's related companies. They invested $1.5 million into EasyLinks, $500,000 or $518,000 of which was after the margin debt came due. They enriched themselves with off-the-books compensation for which, you know, never showed up on any of Loop's tax returns, which... they didn't issue W-2s, they didn't issue 1099s. So the fact that they are looting the company is, I think, evidence that if you allow them to, if you respect the corporate formality here, if you respect the separate liability of Loop Corp, you're going to promote injustice. Because there's a large element of personal choice here. Everything they did was a personal choice by the shareholders. They personally chose to pay themselves, as opposed to using Loop's assets to pay off its margin debt. When they received funding from Banco under the loan document, Loop Corp was allowed to use that additional funding to pay off prior indebtedness. Yet, they chose not to use that Banco money to pay off Loop's margin debt to Wachovia. Instead, they used that money to invest in other ventures that are going to generate additional revenue for them, or they chose to pay themselves. And so that is, the injustice that Judge Kendall is trying to overturn and that she did overturn through piercing Loop's corporate veil. So the four factors that are similar or are identical between Loop Corp, between South Dakota and Illinois are the undercapitalization element, failure to observe corporate formalities, absence of corporate records, and payment of shareholder obligations. And in terms of the undercapitalization argument, they argued at the trial court and they argue now on appeal that Loop Corp was capitalized with $10 million at the time of its incorporation. Judge Kendall did not find that evidence credible. The only credible evidence that Judge Kendall found about capitalization in terms of at the time that Loop was incorporated was $1,000 of paid-in capital. That's what keeps showing up on their annual reports. Also, in June of 1998, Loop Corp was formed in September of 1997. So 9 months later, June of 1998, Loop Corp, through Mr. Greenblatt and Mr. Jehelka, they submit an application to transact business with the Secretary of State of Illinois. They sign that form under penalty of perjury, and they tell the Secretary of State that Loop Corp has $1,000 worth of assets located inside Illinois and $1,000 worth of assets located outside of Illinois. And so those are the representations that they made to the Illinois Secretary of State under penalty of perjury, and Judge Kendall chose to believe their statements on those forms as opposed to the self-serving document, summary document prepared by Loop's in-house accountant, Michael Maig, which was never produced during discovery, and which is simply a summary listing of what Michael Maig believes Loop Corp's assets were. There's no identification in there as to, you know, what the basis is for that. Mr. Maig testified at trial that he never even looked at any source documents. He never made any independent attempt to verify whether or not that capital was, in fact, actually paid into Loop Corp. He simply asked Mr. Greenblatt, Mr. Nichols, Mr. Chelka, and took their word for it.
And is that $1,000, is that a statutory minimum or something? I've been away from that for a long time, but it seemed in incorporating you had to have some basis in $1,000, I thought, was at one time at least, maybe in Indiana. And I'm just wondering if that's all that's really needed, or is that supposed to be an authenticated value?
No, I think I don't know if it's a statutory minimum or not, but I do know that if you're capitalizing a company with $1,000 and then you are entering into multi-million dollar loan transactions and incurring multi-million dollars worth of liability, and all you really have is $1,000, then you're undercapitalized.
Oh, sure. And that's all I'm asking. Is that just a formality to get the thing incorporated with Secretary of State and valid incorporation, or is that supposed to be dated or updated or whatever to show an actual capitalization?
I believe on the annual reports, you're supposed to file in Illinois.
Are those filed somewhere?
The annual reports are filed certainly in Illinois. That's where Loop Corps were filed. And every year they identified the paid-in capital of as $1,000,
okay,
year in and year out. Now, defendants also argue that they shouldn't be considered to be undercapitalized. Loop shouldn't be undercapitalized because, well, Loop Corp had access to loans. They had access to lenders. Well, not so, because Loop's primary lender, Banco, when Banco came to loan Loop money, well, Mr. Greenblatt and Mr. Nichols and Mr. Chelka made the decision that they wouldn't use those loan proceeds to pay off their margin debt to Wachovia. Mr. Greenblatt testified at trial that he wasn't in the business of paying off undersecured creditors, and so he wouldn't let Loop Corp use the loan proceeds. So it's disingenuous for them to say that they had access to capital. They had access to capital, but not to pay judgments and not to pay judgment debts. They had access to capital to fund their investment in EasyLinks, to fund investments in real estate.
Let me ask you about that EasyLinks. How did that get into the case? It wasn't pled, was it?
As
a fraudulent transfer.
No, we
didn't the judge make it very clear that only pled transfers were going to be considered and transfers within a certain time frame?
Correct. And
so how did it get into the case?
Well, and on appeal, we are not asking that you know the court affirm a fraudulent transfer claim as to EasyLinks. The way EasyLinks came to pass is they produced a document identifying during discovery.
Asking us to affirm that. I don't care that much about it.
Okay.
But I am curious about this 2000-2002 lien argument that your opponents
Pursued. I'll address the fraudulent transfer claims. Mr. Curley, he's very adept in his briefs and at arguing that there are two different liens. He keeps referring to a 2000 lien, a 2002 lien, a 2000 lien, a 2002 lien.
And you're all very good. You write very well and in great volume.
Oh, well.
But go
on.
If
you can't have quality, then, you know, I certainly like to have quantity. It's a rare case where we're able to turn out both,
I
suppose.
Go ahead.
It's my job, I suppose, on appeal here to get you away from that and to get you to realize that there are not two different liens. There are two different loans. There was a 2000 loan and a 2002 loan, but there is only one lien. That lien was created in 2000. through that first loan. And then that second loan in 2002 is an amended and restated loan agreement. And it's
so the first loan is what, not 9 or 10 million, and then the second loan is up to what, 17 or 18 million? I can't remember the numbers.
Correct. Loop Corp went into default under the first loan, and then rather than exercise its remedies and act as a legitimate lender in default, Banco chose to give Loop more money, extend more credit to Loop Corp when it was in default after the HRMI margin debt came due. And so Banco loans Loop more money, and it's important to look at the loan transaction, because what we allege and what Judge Kendall found was that the 2002 loan transaction was a fraudulent transfer, was fraudulent, quote-unquote fraudulent, under the UFTA, because the UFTA says a transfer or obligation incurred can be fraudulent under the UFTA. You don't need actual fraud. It has to be a transfer or obligation incurred under the UFTA can be fraudulent if it is done with the intent to hinder or delay or defraud creditors. And our contention is that the 2002 loan was an obligation incurred with the intent to hinder and delay creditors such as Wachovia from recovering on their judgment. And the reason we say that is because we look at the loan transaction itself. And the Banco loan was indeed a sham loan. Yes, Banco loaned money to Loop Corp. Loop Corp had assets. Loop Corp had a bunch of limited liability partnerships that owned brick-and-mortar real estate. The question is, where did Banco get the money to loan Loop Corp those funds for which Loop Corp was giving a blanket security interest over all of these assets? The evidence at trial is that Banco participated the loan to Loop's own subsidiaries. So the very collateral that's being used to secure this loan is actually the source of funding for Banco to loan the money to Loop Corp. So Banco is sucking the money out of Loop's assets and then loaning that money right back to Loop. So if Loop needed access to capital, it could have just gotten the money directly from its subsidiaries. What it did is it entered into this complex loan transaction precisely to allow Mr. Greenblatt to put a giant brick over all of Loop's assets and to make sure that when any creditors came calling, that Mr. Greenblatt got paid before any other creditors did. And so based upon that, and based upon that evidence, Judge Kendall found that the 2002 loan transaction, was a violation of the UFTA. The remedy that she awarded was to void Banco's security interest. So she didn't void the 2002 lien. She didn't void the 2000 lien. She found that the 2002 loan transaction was a fraudulent transfer, and then the remedy under Section 8 was to void Banco's security interest. And if you read her opinion, that's what her order is. She says she voids Banco's security interest in Loop's assets. And that wasn't improper under the UFTA. It was entirely proper under Section 5A1. Now, Mr. Curley, he makes other arguments about 5A2, 6A, Wachovia. We never proceeded under those theories at trial. We're not asking for relief. So to the extent that Judge Kendall may have overstepped her bounds, and I'm not so sure she did, because I think there was evidence that she could have voided Banco's lien under Section 5A2 or Section 6A. But the point is, we didn't ask her to. So,
Mr. Kriesmeier?
Yes.
If we were to affirm this judgment, would Wachovia have a right to its legal fees in this appeal without a ruling under Federal Rule of Procedure of Appellate Procedure 38 or Section 1927?
I believe Wachovia would have a right under the veil piercing claims and under Judge Kendall's order, which specifically granted Wachovia the right to collect its attorney's fees.
So you could file a supplemental petition in the district court?
We could, and her order specifically says any sort of ongoing fees related to collection of that judgment.
Thank you.
Certainly. Well, for all of the reasons that we've stated in our briefs and for all of the reasons that we've stated during our oral argument, unless there are any other questions about either the Banco loan or our bail-piercing claim.
You do have one.
Certainly.
And that is the when Wachovia did, call a margin call, it recovered some assets, I believe. I think I read that it left maybe $1.8 million deficit. But what assets did it recover in that process?
Well, it exercised its rights under the margin agreement.
Yes.
So there were once HRMI basically the value of HRMI stock dropped down to zero, and there was this large balance. Wachovia, whatever holdings were left in that account, Wachovia liquidated and used to satisfy.
So they did have those because they're critical. Because well, you guys didn't get a security agreement and didn't get other things that you could have done to make sure that it wasn't just open-ended, I guess.
Sure. Well, and security agreements and security interests and personal guarantees, those aren't given with margin accounts and with margin loans. As just a matter of business practice, no brokerage firm does that.
But when it falls below a certain level, the margin calls are automatic, aren't they?
Correct.
And apparently, did that HRMI or whatever it is drop so fast there was no time to react or something?
That's correct. I believe NASDAQ delisted the stock, and then the value of HRMI literally dropped from, I don't remember what the position was, but it dropped to zero. They halted trading.
Maybe $10 a share to nothing.
To nothing. And given the volume of HRMI, after we liquidated the remaining positions, we were left with a margin debt that at that time was about $1.8 million. And you know, I think it is a little bit disingenuous for them to argue that Wachovia should have gotten a personal guarantee in connection with the margin loan, not only because that's not how margin loans operate, but also because Mr. Greenblatt himself testified at trial that he considers personal guarantees to be worthless. He finds them worthless himself.
Yeah,
so I think it would be disingenuous to ask Wachovia to have gotten a personal guarantee on a margin debt, especially when no other brokerage firm does that.
Well, the docket number that you referred us to that lists a number of other another number of other margin accounts with lots of others going on. Are they all similar to this, or do you know?
We do know. And what Mr. Greenblatt and Mr. Nichols and Mr. Jahalka were doing, and this is why when this case first began, we styled it as a securities fraud case. When this case first began, we discovered, certainly after the fact, after the margin debt came due, that what Mr. Greenblatt had done is he had opened up, I believe, 19 different margin accounts and different trading accounts through 8 or 9 different brokerage firms in the name of about 11 different shell companies. And every single one of those margin accounts was used to do one thing, acquire massive amounts of HRMI stock.
Was this to disguise their total ownership in the company?
We suspected so. We suspected he was trying to circumvent a standstill agreement that he had entered into with the board of directors and shareholders of HRMI. So that's how the case began. But once we got through the discovery process, we realized we didn't need to pursue a securities fraud claim, and it would be much simpler and more straightforward to simply pierce his corporate veil and to simply void the 2002 Banco loan agreement.
So this was simpler.
I'm sorry?
This was simpler?
This
was simpler than a security case?
Well, believe it or not, it was. So, actually, I do see I have just a tiny bit of time left. I did want to address one more point, and that is Mr. Curley's statute of limitation argument. Well, it's important to know that the first time that Wachovia actually learned of Banco's loan, either the 2000 loan or the 2002 loan, first time we learned of it was March 31, 2005. That's when Loop Corp. produced documents to us.
Wasn't there an Article 9 filing on it, though?
There was an article. Yeah, there was. In 2002, they did file a UCC. However, Wachovia did not yet even have a judgment against Loop Corp until September 22, 2005. Until that time, we had been litigating against Loop Corp in the New York Stock Exchange arbitration proceeding, and then we obtained an award before the NYSE, and then we reduced that award to a judgment until on September, actually 5 years ago, September 22, 2005. And at that point in time, that's when, you know, Wachovia would begin the process of post-judgment discovery. So the question is, you know, when would it have been reasonable for Wachovia to learn of the Banco financing statement? Well, it wouldn't have been reasonable until we actually have a post-judgment, until we have a judgment and we're doing post-judgment discovery. And, of course, we didn't need to discover, you know, the Banco loan or the UCC filing, which, by the way, was never produced by them at trial. They never produced the Banco financing statement at trial. But we wouldn't have had a reason to investigate UCC filings until after September 22, 2005, because that's when we had our judgment. And
our attorney's fees at this time before repeal, is it down to $900,000? Is that outstanding? And as well as, I guess, there's some other costs of $200,000+?
Correct. Those were our attorney's fees. Those excluded. Right. We purposely excluded all of the fees related to the New York Stock Exchange arbitration proceeding. We excluded from our fee petition all of the fees related to the Greg Jordan incident. And those are all of the fees that Wachovia incurred in connection with the trial and the trial court proceedings. And I think there's almost 600 docket entries in this case. So it's been a lengthy case. And those fees and Loop's costs are subsumed within Judge Kendall's judgment. So if there's no further questions,
I will simply
say that for the reasons that we state, we would respectfully ask that the court affirm Judge Kendall's judgment order below.
A couple of points, Your Honors, with respect to some of the things that come up. Mr. Willis is here. He was Loop's lawyer on appeal. His fees were paid by Chip Lease, which is one of the related entities, Your Honor. And that's really all the information he was able to give me here in the courtroom. Counsel talks about the capitalization issue. Plaintiff's Exhibit 16 was a balance sheet prepared by Loop's outside lawyer, Michael May, in 1999. It's a document prepared in the ordinary course of business, and I believe it reflects that Loop had assets in the amount of $43 million from its various real estate holdings. Loop was a holding company. Conclusions of law adopted by a district judge are subject to review on a de novo basis. That's what we argued in our brief. We cited the authority from this court. Counsel stands up here and tells you there was some evidence. I think he said some evidence of actual fraud. It's interesting because this was a fraud case. That's the way they litigated this case below, Your Honors, as a fraud case. Well, Judge Hart dismissed most of the fraud case. Judge Kendall dismissed the rest of it on summary judgment, except for the bit that they withdrew at trial because they couldn't prove it. Mr. Griesmeier tells you that they suspected that they were trying to hide their attempts to purchase stock in Hermie. Well, there were public disclosure requirements. They say they didn't need to make this a securities fraud claim. It wasn't a question of need. It was a question of ability. They couldn't prove a fraud, so that's why the case was tried in the manner in which it was. He talked about a little bit about the participation agreements. It's a lot more complicated than I'm able to figure out, but from my understanding, the participation agreements allowed these other entities to generate revenue without suffering the adverse tax consequences that would have been incurred by the limited partners had the monies been distributed to them directly. So it was all something complicated created by presumably the tax lawyers for the various entities. He talked about the $300,000 that Loop paid to Mr. Nichols and Mr. Jehelka. That's over an approximately 36 to 40-month period, Your Honors. Employees don't have to work for free, even in companies that are in economic distress. And there's nothing in this record whatsoever that indicates that the payments to my clients were in any way disproportionate to the work that they did.
Were those recorded as with W-2s and or 1099s?
I don't believe so, Your Honor. And
is that kind of unusual?
I don't know the answer to that, Judge. I'm not.
You don't?
I'm sorry?
Compensation to an employee without a W-2 or a 1099 is unusual?
There weren't. I don't know where they would have been recorded. Loop didn't file tax returns after 2002 because it didn't have any income. Subsequent to the Hermie collapse, there was nothing there that they were trying to salvage.
You still have to issue a statement to your employee, right?
Right. Well, the employees, it's not like they had this income and they weren't reporting it, Your Honors. There's no evidence of that. There's no evidence that Mr. Nichols or Mr. Jahelka in this record committed tax fraud by not reporting income that they received from Loop.
The question is how to characterize those payments, though.
And I believe they were characterized as distributions to shareholders of the corporation, admittedly not in proportion to the shares that they owned. The individual defendants made those distributions based upon the proportion of the work that they did. For all of the reasons set forth in the briefs before the court, we would respectfully request that the judgments below be reversed in the manner requested in all of the various briefs.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Curley, have some time left?
Yes.
2 minutes. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors. And very quickly, we do think that there were two liens here. But if Wachovia is right and there is only one lien, then it is also right that one lien is the 2000 lien, and any claim under the 2000 lien is clearly time barred by Section 10A of the Transfer Act. Mr. Griesmeier testified, and I use that word advisedly here this morning, that Wachovia didn't learn about that lien until 2005. But as I remarked earlier, there was no evidence in the record below, no one from Wachovia testified as to when and how they learned of the 2000 lien. And as Your Honor pointed out, the UCC filing on June 17th of 2002 put the world on notice of that blanket lien. Whether or not Wachovia didn't bother to make a search of the UCC financing statements until some later time after obtained a judgment is irrelevant. The whole point of filing a financing statement such as that was filed on June 17, 2002, is to put the world on notice of the existence of that lien. Wachovia did not file this lawsuit within 4 years of the 2000 lien. The lien it now admits is the only lien. It would have had to have done so by January 3, 2004. It did not do that, nor did it file within a year after it reasonably could have learned of that lien, because it is charged as a matter of law with learning of that lien on June 17, 2002, by virtue of the UCC filing. I see that my time is up, and unless there are any questions.
I see none, so
thank you very much.
Thank you all, counsel, and the case will be taken under advisement.